Today's program has been brought to you by GreatBrewers.com, a social media marketing platform dedicated to promoting the world's great brewers and the beers they create. For more information, visit GreatBrewers.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, 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 welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Hey, we're recording today, November 11th, 2013. You might be hearing this in 2014, but we've got some special guests in town for the Union Beer Portfolio Tasting, so we had to do a special recording. Dave Broderick from Blind Tigers here. How are you, buddy?
Hey, Jimmy. How you doing?
All right, we brought some of your friends. We got Bobby from The Gate. How are you, Bobby?
How you doing?
And we've got from the Pacific Northwest here for the Union Beer Tasting, we've got Irene and Jamie from Full Sail.
Hello, how's it going?
And hey, Dick Cantwell from Elysian.
Hi, delighted to be here.
And a new buddy, Ray Darmstadt from San Gambrinus Beer Shop.
Hey, Jimmy.
All right, and Tim Stendel from Union Beer. Okay.
Good to be here.
This is pretty cool. So we're here. We're meeting on a Monday, or it's actually about 11 o'clock. And so we're not sure when you're going to hear this, but sometime soon. And Union Beer did this really great. It's every 3 or 4 years, Tim?
Yeah, it's about every 3 years. It takes a lot of coordination, a lot of effort in order to get all the brewers out here, owners, and to just corral as many people as it takes to do this event. So it's only once about every 3 years, but it's a pretty spectacular event.
And how many brewers are in town for this?
Probably between 70% and 80% of our portfolio is represented by the owner, the brewmaster, or someone who has a very significant hand in the brewery. So it's a pretty significant portion of our entire portfolio.
And it's open up to the first time. It's open up to the public on Wednesday.
Yeah, in the past we've only done two of these events in the past. One in 2007, one in 2009, and again this year, 2013.
What? No, I'm just wondering, and so this year it is open to the public.
Yeah, so in the past it's been industry only, by invite only, but this year we had so many people request to be part of the event that we decided that it really needed to be open up to the public as well. So this will be the first time, and hopefully going forward we'll be able to have a second day for the public as well.
Is it two sessions for the public on Wednesday?
No, it's two sessions for the industry on Tuesday, November 12th, and then one session for the public on the evening of Wednesday, November 13th.
All right. Well, in recognition of that, we've got Dave's here from Blind Tiger and Bobby Gagnon from The Gate. We'll first start talking to you guys because it's your first time on, Bobby.
That's it.
And you guys have been industry leaders for a long time. You know, you've seen the change in craft beer industry. What are some of the brewers or the breweries that you'd look forward to tasting this week?
Well, for me, it's the full portfolio. I think that's the most exciting part of it, is that, to be able to come in and, sort of taste across the portfolio rather than what comes through the door as we order piecemeal. Yeah. And meet everyone.
Yeah, and I think they tend to bring some special stuff that you might not see in kegs, or be able to sell yourself. They're there, obviously, to really show people what they're capable of. So I remember from the last two that there were some really nice bottles being poured.
So let's talk to Bobby. I know you guys have been friends a long time, Dave.
We bartended together.
Let's ask him about how you guys started, because you and along with Blind Tiger, one of the legendary New York beer bars.
Oh, legendary.
Yeah. I throw my spoon.
Hang around long enough, you become legendary.
I started as a bartender, essentially, and worked in a beer bar in Hollywood called Barney's Beanery, widely known, well known. 200-plus bottles of beer and about a dozen drafts. And that was, being a kid from Boston, Massachusetts, that was a huge education. I came up drinking Heineken, Budweiser, and ended up at Barney's Beanery with a couple of hundred beers and pretty much tasted them all. And then I moved to New York and met Dave, and Dave was beginning to make inroads into what became the Blind Tiger, and we spent a lot of time tasting, talking about this the New York, what became the New York craft beer movement, which was pretty slow in the beginning to start up.
Yeah, and I remember back then we were like, wow, can, you know, DBA had just opened up, I think they opened up in 04, and we were like, do you think, you know, New York can support like another beer bar, you know, is it big enough to have two? And because you just didn't know. I mean, it just wasn't a big deal back then. And Ray and Dennis had sort of been talked into selling craft beer and really dedicating the place to it. I don't think when they first were looking at that location that's the way they were going to go. They weren't sure what they were going to do. But they were convinced, and they did it. And then we were like, okay, let's try it.
Yeah, how soon after DBA was the Tiger?
We were March 06, and they were a year and a half before. And then Ginger Man opened up like 2 weeks after us.
Right,
so it was all kind of right around the same time.
And then we came in a year after in May.
Yeah,
97.
Right.
Yeah, and that was, you know, there were a handful of us, you know, and there was, it was work. You know, we were out there basically trying to put the beer in people's hands and educate them, and now they're educating us.
And we're in Park Slope, where you were, there was nothing, especially on Fifth, there was nothing.
Yeah, so. As I was just saying to Jimmy, it was definitely hinterlands at that, you know, pizza places and bodegas and us. You know, mm-hmm. We turned on a couple of lights and people started coming in and saying, 24 draft beers. Let me try that.
So back then, Bobby, what were some of the brands that you were serving at the gate in 1997?
Primarily, Dave, you could help me out with this. Primarily, we were dealing with a lot of German, Belgian, English, and a few American crafts.
Brooklyn was big. Yeah. I mean, I think we had like five Brooklyn lines. I think probably had like
Sierra Nevada,
four or five. Sierra Nevada,
Anchor
was big.
Steam.
Yeah,
you know.
But yeah, if you looked at our opening list, you'd be like, Pete's Wicked was big back then.
That's right.
There were a lot of brands.
Pyramid was another one.
Pyramid,
from the West.
Wild Goose.
Yeah.
A lot of brands that had kind of gone by the wayside. So it was a very different list from what it is now.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And now, you know, it's so much more American craft, you know, now than it was then. We were definitely, I would say, 60 to 65%, possibly 70% import.
Yeah.
You know.
And Dick Cantwell, you're here from Elysian in Seattle. So you were around back then.
I certainly was. So were Jamie and Irene, of course. We didn't send beer to this market back then, but we do now. And the years that these guys are talking about, 96, that's right when opened our first location on Capitol Hill in Seattle. Hmm.
And then what did you think about New York? Or did you think about New York at all back then?
New York at all? Yeah. I loved it. I always miss it. I lived here for a couple of years back in the 80s. So, you know, and my brothers have both lived here over the years, too, so I've come back periodically and watch it change. And, you know, it really seems like there's a quickening in the last couple of years, even with the progress that these guys are talking about with brand recognition and expansion of American craft beer. There are more, you're talking about wondering if New York can sustain a second craft beer bar, and, you know, of course, they're all over the place. Mm-hmm. And the places that even a few years ago were saying, oh, we'd love to get in more of that, but we don't have the space. Well, it seems like people have the space now.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then, so talk about Elysian. So you guys started in the 90s.
We started in 96 in Seattle, where we have been primarily a pub company for most of our history. We now operate three pubs in Seattle. We have a big one near the stadiums called Elysian Fields, our original one. It's about a 200-seat joint. And then we have a small neighborhood place about 5 miles north of us. And as of a couple of years ago, we operate a production brewery in a cool, sort of artisty welding kind of part of town called Georgetown. That's where our production brewery is now, and that makes it possible for us to make enough beer to, you know, have a presence outside of our own home market. So it's been going well, and I thought we were done with pubs, but we're going to open another one within a few months.
So where do you spend most of your time now, Dick?
That's a good question. I once wrote an article about operating multiple locations, and I started by transcribing that part in Goodfellas, the day he gets busted, where, you know, he has to make the tomato sauce and drop off the guns to the guys from Florida and all that stuff. And so I wrote that part, and then I wrote what my day was like, you know, checking in with my guys at the different brewing locations and calling up for raw materials and all that stuff. I spend a lot of time driving, but I try not to spend all my time driving. I do like to check in with everybody because I think it's really important for the continuity, and also for, at this point, I feel like sort of the mentoring that I do for some of my younger brewers is really, really important. But I do tend to sit at a table right next to the brewery at our original location with my iPad open and do most of my work there.
So do you like manage managers, manage brewers, and just spend a lot of time in, you know, meeting with them, just sort of setting the tone?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I think it's, as I said, I think that's really important, especially now that we're operating the production brewery, because I think some of those guys, it's a much less social kind of situation than it was when we were just pubs, you know, because they had more interaction with the public and with each other, you know, because a production brewery space is spread out. Communication is really, really important. You know, if something's going on not 10 feet from you as it is in a pub setting, but, you know, all the way across the room, and people don't always know what's going on, and it's important to sort of knit that together. I think another important thing I do is involve my guys in recipe formulation. I used to do all that myself. And in the last few years, I think it's been really important to have a little sort of committee. We have periodic meetings with all the brewers to talk about what we all want to do in the next couple of months. And since we have those pubs, we have that kind of flexibility. We're able to have, you know, 20 different beers on from our breweries, shipping between those different locations. And there's a lot of opportunity for people to have individual input, come up with their own recipes, and that's resulted in some of our most successful seasonals.
So do you guys also serve other beers at your pubs?
Well, we do. You know, we have. These days with so many pubs, we don't really need to. You know, we do bring things in periodically, you know, if something really terrific is in the market, which, of course, it always is. But generally, it's our beers. We do keep a tap open in each of our places for a New Belgium tap because we've done a lot of work over the last 4 or 5 years with New Belgium, sort of a nice symbiosis that we have with them. But it's not a philosophical objection to having them. It's just that we have so many of our own beers that we don't often pour outside beers.
Dick, how did you get into beer? Because you seem like a philosophical guy. And, you know, you just wrote a book. You rewrote the book. It's the Brewers Association Guide to Starting Your Own Brewery.
Right. I got into beer just, I don't know. I mean, I've always been into beer. One thing that's kind of funny is that my introduction to Belgian beer came because my ex-wife is still an art historian, and so her specialty was 15th and 16th century Dutch and Flemish painting, which is what she was doing while we were here in New York. She worked at the Met. And on our trips to Belgium, you know, we'd look at art and we'd drink beer because, of course, you're going to do that. But I really got into brewing more seriously when my daughter was born because I'd been writing during the days, and, you know, all of a sudden I didn't have those long stretches of time because I was taking care of her during that time. I took care of her at home for about a year and a half, working nights, and I'd started home brewing, and that was something that was creative I could do while she was around. And I've continued writing, but these days it's mostly about beer. And yes, I'm very pleased that the book is finally out. It's been out since about May, and it's a pretty thorough redo of the previous edition. The previous edition was a pastiche of essays by a lot of different people. Each person took a different chapter, but I thought it was important to have a single voice for all of it. And the previous edition was done several years ago, and of course the world has changed since then completely. And so there's a lot of advice. None of it comprehensive. I can't claim to be an expert about any particular subject. But I think the experience that I've gained in the last 20 or so years in the industry has made it possible for me to weigh in not just on stuff like recipes and all that. There's not much advice about that kind of thing in there, but there is about portfolio and marketing, how to work with a distributor, things you need to think about as you're getting started and thinking about getting started. I just want people to go into it with their eyes open, if at all possible.
Yeah, with so many new breweries and breweries that have been around for a while, you know, what's your main advice to would-be startups? I mean, what are they? You know, I always think that they really need to have some kind of a vision for how they're going to be different. But I mean, what are some of the things that you say to them or say in that book to them?
Absolutely, I think differentiation. You know, having that vision, having a vision, and not just sort of going into it and saying, "Well, I make great beer, so my business is going to be a success." You have to have an identity. It doesn't have to be a slavish identity, but you do have to have some sort of idea about what the thrust of your approach is going to be, whether it's label design and the types of beers you choose to brew, what your place looks like. I mean, every decision you make is a branding decision. And I think an awful lot of people, you know, back, say, in the earlier boom times of craft brewing's beginnings, people thought that you know, just a great beer or two was going to be enough to sell itself. And these days, with a new brewery literally, well, two new breweries literally opening every day in this country, you absolutely have to sort of mark out some territory so that people will remember you. Even, you know, even if your beer is great, you know, you can, people can say, oh, I had a great beer the other day. What was it called? Oh, I don't remember. But you have to make sure that people do remember, because there is limited sort of attention span for consumers, distributors, retailers, everybody. And you have to do that recognizing that it's a very crowded market. I gave a talk at the National Homebrewers Conference back in whatever month that was, June, and I took every chapter of the book and talked about specifically the angle of a crowded market and how people should really sort of keep that stuff in mind. My favorite was the chapter about floors, when my main advice, my axiom for that one was squeegee less than your competitors.
Mm-hmm. All right. I think that's all you have to say.
Yeah. Sums it up.
Yeah. Well, hey, first a quick shout out. If you have any questions for us ever, the best thing to do is send it to us on Twitter, @beer_sessions, and we'd love to get your questions on the air. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a few minutes. We've got a lot more on the show on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
You are listening to I Like Ye by Roberta's Own Hard Bodies on the Heritage Radio Network.org.
So, you like good beer. Whether you're a craft beer pro or just had your first sip of an IPA, GreatBrewers.com is your number one beer resource on the internet. GreatBrewers.com bridges the gap between the world's great brewers and the consumers who enjoy their products. With so much information and misinformation out there, GreatBrewers.com focuses on education and leaves no stone unturned. Take the Great Beer Test on their website and browse through an extensive product catalog. Download their mobile beer cloud app, which includes a GPS beer finder, a beer sommelier, and descriptions for over 5,000 different brews. What are you waiting for? Back up that passion for craft beer with some solid information and education. Visit GreatBrewers.com today.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Thanks again to GreatBrewers.com, and they're also bringing to you this great trade tasting this week. So we've got Dick Cantwell from Elysian and Irene Fermat and Jamie Emerson from Full Sail here in the house. We've got another guest, Ray Darmstadt, who's just opened up St. Gambrinus Beer Shop. Earlier we were talking about how in 1997, 96, when Blind Tiger and the Gate opened, there weren't too many other beer bars around, but now there's a lot. And you've opened a specialty beer shop.
Yes. We're on Atlantic Avenue, just really close to the Barclays Arena. We've been open up since the week before Labor Day. And things are going pretty good so far. We have 16 beers on tap and shelves in the back where we have bottles. We're eventually going to add refrigeration. And we have food. Everything's going really good so far for the first 10 weeks anyway.
What was the first beer that you brought for us?
I bought Sierra Celebration.
And why did you pick that?
Well, the four main partners all met at the Blind Tiger. And basically, Sierra Celebration was one of the first beers that really opened up my eyes to, you know, good beer, hoppy beer. And basically, we became friends with a lot more than just, you know, a lot of people at the Tiger. And Celebration was probably one of the main beers that we all sort of bonded over. All different types of people, all different walks of life, but we all just loved the beer.
Yeah, Ray was kind of the mayor of the Blind Tiger. We're a little leaderless. We're leaderless right now. We've got to elect a new one.
So all these good customers are starting to open their own businesses.
It stinks.
You must make it look too easy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, talk about people that are pros that have made it. You guys, Full Sail up in Hood River,
Hood River,
Oregon. Irene Fermat and Jamie Emerson. Welcome to the show, guys.
Hey.
Great to be here.
You know, it's great having you guys. I know the Union Beer Portfolio is going on, so we get people from all over the world coming to town. I know my friend Mr. Cayucci from Hitachino Brewery is here. We're going to see him this week. So what do you guys think about being in New York?
Well, I grew up in New York, so I'm thrilled to be here anytime that we're here. So it's wonderful.
I'm from the little town in the Midwest, so I love the big city.
Well, I'll tell you what, I was looking at a video of you guys today, and this Hood River, you know, Oregon, it's like, I'm going to move there. It's just like flowing water, and you're talking about sustainability and how you guys have... You've figured out you're the most water efficient brewery now in the world or something.
Oh, I don't think we're the most water efficient, but we're pretty good. We switched to a mash filter about 3 years ago, which is a Belgian piece of equipment, and you know, typical German brewery runs a louder tub, and a louder will drop 80% moisture, so say 2,000 pounds of husk and 8,000 pounds of water, and a mash filter drops about 65% moisture, which doesn't seem like a lot. But for us, it was about 800 gallons of water per brew. So water weighs 8 pounds a gallon, so quite a bit of weight. Then you're not shipping out in spent grain. And what you end up with is we saved about 1 million gallons of water over that course of that year.
Yeah.
So we were, before with a louder tub, we were about 3.5 gallons to a water use for every gallon of beer. And now we're about 2.5 gallons of water to every gallon of beer. And, of course, the Germans don't believe it works because it's Belgian.
And those numbers might not sound like much, but that is a remarkable ratio.
What's a typical brewery using for water for every gallon of beer?
6 to 10.
Wow. And what do you guys do at Elysian?
I wish I could say we were anywhere close to what these guys do, but probably 6, honestly.
Yeah.
I think it's harder in the pub environment, honestly.
Yeah.
Because you have a lot of usage than in the restaurant part of the pub itself. You know, that is counted against your ratio, right? It's hard.
Yeah, dishwashers, ice machines, those count.
Yep.
And those are hard.
And those are hard
to do. So.
And public restrooms.
But it was interesting when you were saying, could it handle one more bar? You know, when we started the brewery back in 1987, there were already 3 breweries in Portland. And the reason we're in Hood River is we thought, no way.
No way.
We were a little wrong about that, obviously. Right now, I think Portland has something like
62
breweries in Portland. There's 140 in the state. One of my favorite is right in Hood River, which is a town of 5,000 people. We have 8 breweries.
8 breweries.
And they were all just like you, brewers who worked for us, who started their breweries. So it's kind of
an
interesting historical spread we've seen here over all these years.
Wow. Dave, you've toured the country and visited a lot of breweries. Have you ever been out to Full Sail?
No, I haven't.
Or Elysian?
I did get to go to Portland 10 years ago, and I got to spend, I forget why I was there, but I got to spend a few days there just really kind of toured the town more than the brewing. And but I am definitely, I think the Craft Brewers Conference is out in Portland, not next year, it's in Denver, but the year after that, I think.
The year after that,
yeah. So I'm planning on going out and spending a couple weeks and just touring around.
Well,
looking
great.
Forward to it.
Come out to the brewery.
Yeah,
we have a
for
pretty
sure.
cool location. We're right on the river, so we're on the Oregon side, but Washington is right across.
The mighty Columbia.
The mighty Columbia.
Having just been there, Dave.
That's right, Bobby was
even
just there.
Even though it rained, I'm sorry about that when you were there.
It's a stunning location.
Yeah. Well, this is kind of a packed room. I mean, this is an amazing show today. We've got, you know, new beer bars and legendary beer bars and you guys, the two breweries. But tell us more about when you got started, because, you know, we don't think too much about the 80s in terms of craft beer, and many of us weren't working in the industry then.
I was very, very young. It was a really exciting time. I mean, it really felt, for I think many of us who started our breweries back in the 80s, it was, we traveled Europe. Most of us, you know, the backpacking thing right after college, and you had these amazing beers. And you came back, and it was so deep about quality of life issues for us. And we really wanted to bring some of that back to the United States. And I think it's such an interesting piece, and that's why I'm such a deep believer in craft, because I think overall it's just part of that trend. When you look at the whole growth of winery, cheese making, coffee, all of it,
good
it's
bread.
People who really wanted to improve these pieces that really make the quality of life for us. So it was pretty exciting. Not the easiest concept to explain back then.
Very hard to get financing.
Impossible. People were like, why? There's 3 perfectly good breweries. Why you're doing this? You know? So I think for most of us who started very early, it was a lot of bootstrapping, which in itself was not a bad discipline. You know, so it was exciting, and it's amazing where it is right now.
What was the first the size of the first brewery you had. Tell us a little bit about the operation.
We did 287 barrels the first year, and they were very, very painful. First bottling we did took us 24 hours, and I think we did 10 cases of beer. There's a picture of all of us exhausted over the 10 cases of beer. So, you know, we definitely had the learning curve.
Well, the licensing people from the state. We had ladies that had never licensed anybody.
Yeah.
You know, the last license in Oregon was the, besides the three guys in Portland, was Henry Weinhardt's back in the 1800s. So they didn't know, you know, like, is there a tax paid line? It was stumbling around. I mean, really different. And then, of course, we go in for the license, and the lady says, Oregon Liquor Control, what's a four-letter word for alcohol? And I said, beer. And she said, no. Wine? No. The four-letter word for alcohol is drug. That's what we're here to talk about.
Ooh, and you thought, this is not going to be fun for 3 hours.
Craft drugs.
That's why we got into it, right?
Yeah.
It was really kind of funny because you look back on that, and it was rolling as much as you could go, fast, and really trying to keep quality up and packaging standards up and all those things that really make the difference, because all of a sudden, you know, we're not giving beer to our friends anymore. Now we're putting it on the shelf at Safeway, and it's, you have to be on it, you know?
It's serious. But I remember the perspective of it. Sierra, that was our hero and still is, had been around almost 10 years longer than us, and they were doing 15,000 barrels.
Yeah.
And we just thought that was just an unbelievable number.
I don't know how you'd ever get there.
I don't know. We just couldn't visualize that, you know? And I think that sense of scope has really changed.
So what was the first beer you made that really took off for you?
First beer we made was Golden Ale, which was a cream ale, and it was a very nice beer. It didn't survive into the modern times. The second beer we made was Imperial Porter, Imperial Stout, and that's actually the beer that goes in the bourbon casks today, that same recipe. And then the third beer was Wassail, which we brought today actually to try, and then Amber came after that, and that was when it really kind of started taking off.
What are we drinking right now?
This is one of my beers, The Loser, which started out as a 20th anniversary beer that we brewed in conjunction with Sub Pop Records. I almost said Sub Pop Ales. but we got together with them and picked a couple of recipe elements out to make this. And one of the things that this beer has that's kind of notable is that this was one of the first beers that was generally made with Sriracha Ace hops. We actually were the first brewery to use those in North America, as far as I know, because the Gamache family, that is the only family that grows them, Darren Gamache called me up and he said, we grew three plants of this Japanese variety, we're going to pelletize it, and we want you to try something with it, and we're going to send it all to you. And that's one of the great things about living close to the hop-producing areas, is we all, and I include these guys too, because the Willamette Valley and the Yakima Valleys are, you know, so close to so many breweries there. We get calls from people doing experimental hop varieties that they want us to try out so that they can see what a beer will be like. I'm doing an event later this week with Tim and the union guys at Bitter and Esther's. We're making a homebrew. I brought 5 pounds of an experimental hop that's now known only as 366, and we'll fool around with that.
Wow, that sounds great. Yeah. Cool. Hey, cheers to everybody.
Cheers.
All right. And Tim, what are some of the Full Sail and Elysian beers that do well here in New York City?
Well, with Full Sail, the session has become really a mainstay and a staple in a lot of on-premise and off-premise locations. Session lager, for the people that aren't familiar with it, it's won countless medals at GABF, World Beer Cup, international beer festivals all over the place. It's really one of the gems, whether it's hidden or not. For some people, it's one of the best American lagers on the market. It's all malt, just incredibly well balanced. But they've got some extensions on it. The Session Black, which is my go-to beer in terms of the Session series, and Session Fest as well. It also comes out right around this time of year. That we're currently talking. I don't know when this is going to air.
Christmas time.
and then the regular Full Sail lineup with the IPA and the Amber. Those are just incredibly well balanced, great representations of those particular styles. So everything that Full Sail has to offer tends to be very consistent throughout the year. But probably in New York, the workhorse is the Session line. Just dead solid, great products. And with Elysian, their strength is really the versatility of their entire brewing operation. So many different styles come to New York. They did an Apocalypse series a couple years ago. This past year, we really highlighted their pumpkin beers. Elysian is very well known for influencing pumpkin beers all around the country. Dick is well known in the brewing community for getting other brewers very drunk and committing them to making pumpkin beers.
I think you have, like, you told me you have 80 recipes right now, something like that.
Oh, I'm sure we do, yeah. I mean, we've made quite a few pumpkin. I mean, this last year for our Pumpkin Ale Festival that we have every year, we poured a total of, I think, 81 from various breweries, but 15 of those recipes were ours, and there were 7 collaborations we'd done with other breweries.
Wow. And I had a pepper saison, too. This fall? Or?
Oh, yeah, the Oddland series. Yeah, the peppercorn saison that we did with green, black, white, and pink peppercorns. Yep, always fooling around.
And I was very excited to hear that the Super Fuzz is coming back.
It
was
What's
one
the
of Super my favorite, the Elysian Super Fuzz, the Blood Orange Pale.
The Super Fuzz, yeah, our Blood Orange Pale Ale. That really took off for us last year. You know, the kind of groovy psychedelic label didn't hurt, but I think it was a nice balance. The blood orange is an element. There's also blood orange peel in it. You know, I've actually answered some emails from people who were disappointed that it didn't taste like fruit juice, but I've gotten many more emails from people who thought who really enjoyed it, and that'll be back this summer.
I've had a few beers that have made with fruit, and I don't appreciate a beer with fruit juice. You know, so there's some guys making beers like, I don't want to say the brands, but it's like they're putting apricots in apricot juice in with a beer, or it's like, you know, the fake lambics where there's ale mixed with fruit.
Right.
I mean,
well, I think balance is what it's all about. Tim was talking about how well balanced the Full Sail beers are, and that's very, very true. And I think that's sort of the watchword. Whenever anybody asks me what the most important element of any recipe that I put together or that we put together, it's balance. Even if a beer is intense, even if it's flavorful or super hoppy, it's still got to be balanced.
Yeah, and I think that whole balance thing is critical. The Germans have an expression that the first beer should call for the third. And as brewers, we love that. As bar owners, you guys should too.
Absolutely.
And we really strive to make those beers, and that is about balance. It's about a flavor palette that keeps you intrigued, where there's not one single note that just keeps playing, but that you keep having this interchange of flavors from malt to hops and back and forth. But you can't get that without balance.
Well, and there's a scientific part behind it as well, where, you know, the human body is still animal in some way, and you know, you turn a fan on in your room at night, it makes noise, and eventually your brain shuts off the noise because it's listening for saber-toothed tiger or whatever. I mean, you know, you think about old genes, and the palate works the same way. So if something's hyper-bitter, the first drinks are very intense, maybe, you know, very big amplitude, all that kind of stuff, but then your palate shuts those flavors down and what's left behind it. So if you have hops, you have malt, you have alcohol in balance, the palate fatigues across all flavors at the same time, and the beer remains tasting like the beer. And so that first beer calls for the third.
It's brilliant.
Yeah.
Wow. And Ray, when you've opened your shop, San Cabrinas, I mean, what are you looking for in beers now? Because there's so many choices and so many great brewers.
Well, we've got to get people in the door. So I'm trying to keep up like a good list of like the hot beers or good beers or something that'll get people like, oh wow, that's, I never saw that before. And then trying to keep the shelves, we're kind of limited in space, so I'm trying to keep just the good ones, maybe the top tier beers there, get people to come in, and then you've got to, once you get them in the door, you've got to sell them. One of Tim's brands, like Main Beer Company, is like very hot right now, so we've got some of their beers on the shelves, and people like grab that and like, oh well, if you like that, you know, maybe you can try this one down here. Just trying to keep things, like I said, like everybody said, balance, but keep it up.
Awesome. Hey, we're gonna have to take a short break. We'll be back in a few minutes. We got such great guests here on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
This one's called Target Practice by Hard Bodies on the Heritage Radio Network.org.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio. We got a full room. Dave Broderick, Blind Tiger. Everybody, say their name and say where you're from, because this is too much fun.
Dave Broderick, Blind Tiger.
Tim Stendahl, Union Beer Distributors.
Ray Darmstadt, St. Gambrina's Beer Shop.
Dick Cantwell from Elysian Brewing in Seattle.
Jamie Emerson, Full Sail Brewery.
Irene Firm at Full Sail.
Bobby Gagnon, The Gate in Park Slope, Brooklyn.
All right, and Jimmy Carboni from Jimmy's Number 43. Well, we're drinking. We've moved on from the Elysian Loser. We had Sierra Nevada Celebration, and now we're drinking something from Full Sail.
Cheers.
Cheers.
What is it, Irene?
Wassail. Wassail is something that we did back in 1988, and we were trying to recreate a tradition that I think a lot of craft brewers really loved, which was an old-school tradition of how do you thank your customers at the end of the year for being your customers. And it was to brew a really special beer that had just a bit more of everything. And so Wassail is our winter beer, and so it has a bit more of malt and hops and alcohol and all of those good things. And it really, like so many things about craft beer, I think it really brings back pieces that just make the whole beer world that much richer, that much deeper. You know, as a woman, I've never been very fond of the Bikini Babes way of selling beer. And that's one of the things I love about craft beer, that we talk respectfully to our customers about culture and heritage and just the camaraderie and the joy of drinking beer.
Was there ever a time when you guys thought that this wasn't going to work and you were going to get out of it? I mean, you've been doing this over 20 years.
All the time. 26, yeah, 26. And, yeah, I think you can't be in a business like this that evolves and changes so quickly and have any sense of status quo. You know, I think it's pretty humbling all the time. And I think it is really always a challenge to say, who are we deeply, and where are we just going to be the way we are regardless of what's hot at the moment? And that's always a challenge, I think. And for us, we believe in very classic, balanced beer styles. So when the world is really about IBU, arms race, that's not really what we make. And so we're willing to ride it out just to stay really true to our vision of what we believe are the beers that make sense.
You know, I was reading about your brewery, and also Dick earlier was talking about Elysian. I know you guys are in the heart of hop country and everything, Pacific Northwest.
Yeah.
Do you buy most of your ingredients from local farms?
Yeah, 99.9 or 99.8. It's all local within basically 100 miles of the brewery. Malt house is in Vancouver, Washington. Barley is grown in Eastern Oregon, Eastern Washington, Idaho, and Montana. The hops were right between the two hop fields, basically, on the drive between the valley and Yakima. So we had a lot of hop growers between, and, you know, they'll drop off packs of whatever. It's like, oh, check this out.
They're goodies, yeah.
And, we had just a side story. We had some hops that showed up from one of the growers, and they smelled like candied pineapples. They were wonderful. So we brewed a pail up with it, dry hopped it, and had everybody come in, put it on cask. So we tweeted it and posted it and all like that, and he poured it out, and it smelled like a sweaty 16-year-old boy. It was terrible.
So we learned before we do a lot of social networking and bring people on in, we better taste it first. Yeah.
I have actually brewed before with this hop that I'm brewing with on Thursday, so it doesn't smell like that. But I'm very familiar with that disappointment.
Right.
You know, something that you rub it between your hands and it's just ethereal and transcendent and wonderful, and then you brew with it and it's not quite as wonderful.
Yeah. Cooking changes things.
The reverse can be true as well. Yes, you know, something can be very quiet, very subtle when you brew with it, and then you and when you first smell it, and then you brew with it, and it just opens up and becomes something that you know that a lot of people are going to want to taste and brew with.
Well, and I think the hop farmers too are a really cool part of the whole craft beer story, because if you go and look at so many of these farms, they're 3-4 generation family farms, and when you looked at when they started really reinvesting in all their harvesting equipment and all, it was in the 90s and early 2000s. And that really is a wonderful piece of craft beer that our relationships with our farmers have helped them to thrive.
Yeah, if there's one good thing to be said about the hop crisis of about 5 years ago, when we all, you know, suddenly were, you know, there was a rude awakening, hops, nearly everything went wrong that could have gone wrong with the hop market and the growing season and everything else, is it brought about much greater communication between brewers and farmers. And so now I think I see farmers coming through my place. I'm sure these guys do too, all the time, just coming over to Seattle, check things out, bring things over. Far more brewers than ever before go to Yakima, and I'm sure to the Willamette Valley as well, for hop selection, to test out the different lots of each different variety and pick the lots that they want to really help forge another sort of more pieces of their identity and the flavors that they brew with. It's been very, very exciting. And now there's a brewery, the Smith family, who have Loftus Farms, have started a brewery literally in the middle of the hop fields there called Balebreaker, and it's terrific. Their beers are wonderful, and you know, so it's really going full circle in many different ways.
Well, the other part of the full circle is the German hop growers.
We have the we had Tettnang hop growers out at the brewery about 6 weeks ago before harvest, because harvest in Germany was going to be late. So we had the group from Tettnang out, and they were coming between the two fields, and they were in the brewery, and we were making these classic styles, but basically with Northwest ingredients. And so they were actually worried that noble hops were becoming passé, that you know, German hops were being ignored. And so they had planted 10 hectares of Cascades in the Tettnang to grow North American hops in Germany, which would probably be really kind of cool.
Sure,
you know, you think the terroir or whatever would be really interesting. But, you know, they were worried that people would pass them by. And it's like, well, they're still wonderful hops. I mean, they're just not like some of the crazy hops in the States, that's all.
But I love that circular thing of all of a sudden the German hop growers are copying the American hop growers, right? Our farmers are taking the lead
there. We see that kind of tennis match with styles, too. Mm-hmm. You know, the way IPAs are taken on by Belgians, who brew IPAs with Belgian yeast, who send it back to us, and then we brew our own version of a Belgian-style IPA with American hops or maybe with some other hops. It goes back and forth. I mean, you almost don't know what style belongs to whom anymore. And for those of us who pay attention, well, we kind of know that, but that's one of the things, one of the trivia games that's really fun to play among all of our efforts.
I think that's why we like beer so much. You know, it's like mm-hmm. the old traditions are trying new ingredients, mm-hmm. and you guys are picking up old traditions, and that's what kind of keeps it fresh. I mean, Dave, you're up in Vermont now. You got Worthy Burger, Worthy Kitchen, and you're exposed to a lot of beer, more than most of us, I think, because you're in New York and Vermont, and you've been around the country. I don't know. What do you think about all this stuff?
Yeah, no, I think it's interesting, you know, after being in New York for over 20 years and then moving to a small town in Vermont, it's, you know, extremely different. And when, you know, when I first got to Vermont, there was Long Trail and Otter Creek and I guess Harpoon had bought the Windsor plant. So there was, you know, three big breweries.
Catamount.
But not much. Well, yeah. And Catamount was, mm-hmm. but Catamount was already gone by the time I got up there.
Yeah.
And so to see the change now, it's all about small brewers in Vermont and much more connected with the land and really trying to, you know, follow that. They do farmstead breweries. That's a big thing up there now. So it's just and it's very localized. You know, they really want to drink product from Vermont. And so, you know, that's just a big change for up there. And for me, you know, coming from New York, from a very international place where all the, you know, it seems like all the beer is sort of congregate in New York at some point in time. You get to try a lot of different things. So up there, I don't. You know, I really kind of have to drink what's up there. So it's very different.
Could be worse.
Could be a lot worse.
I'm not complaining. I got a Twitter question that came in, so we're going to ask everyone in the room can answer that. So it's from at Good Beer Seal, our friends. They wanted to know, ask each of you what beer you would like to brew for Christmas style, or is there a favorite Christmas style beer that you would like to serve or purchase? Anybody can go first if they want to.
Well, we have done a lot of different Christmas beers over the years. Our sort of flagship Christmas beer that we actually put into package is called Bifrost. It's a strong pale ale that finishes with Slovenian Styrian Goldings. And I guess that was sort of my little sort of rebellion against the spiced Christmas beer, which for a while was kind of de rigueur, as, you know, homebrewers and everybody would come out with something special. And I like those too, but I didn't think that really had the commercial legs that something different would have. The seasonal IPA that we have out right now, Valhalla, began as a Christmas IPA, which certainly took some influence from the Sierra Nevada Celebration Ale that we started with, which really, if I had to pick a desert island beer, that might be it, the Celebration. But I also do a chestnut brown ale with chestnuts. I felt like that was kind of seasonal.
That sounds good.
We have done other spice things. We've done a Belgian Christmas beer, what we've called a Belgian Christmas beer, a strong, sort of even extra strong double ale. Our Belgian triple is called Bête Blanche. That one we call Bête Noël. So I like to come out with at least a half a dozen different Christmas beers every year, if we can. New ones all the time.
For me, it's I spent a lot of time in Munich my last year of university, and Germans. The whole lager piece always has been one of my big pieces that captures my imagination. You go to Munich and they have Weihnachtsfest beer, which is a really lovely pale Bock. And that influenced the LTD4, which is coming out here post-Christmas. But we have Wassail, which we're drinking today, which is a strong ale. The lovely old kind of English style. The recipe for Wassail doesn't change every year. It's only the hops that shift. So the ones that we find that are the best of the year go into Wassail. So this year is Northern Brewers and Brewers Golds, just a really nice lineup. Then Session Fest, which Tim mentioned earlier, it's a Czech lager beer, Polotomava, which means semi-dark, and 6.2 alcohol. Really nice caramel flavors. Creamy, in a way, I think, is one of the big things there. Very smooth. And we have Wreck the Halls. Yeah, well, LTD Black Bock. That's the LTD series. That's a Czech style called Serene, and that's a 7% Doppelbock, but has notes of roast, which you don't really typically find in, say, a German style. And just a lovely variety of beers for the celebrating the season that I think go with colder weather really well, and help soften the blows of visiting relatives.
That's kind of our criteria there. That's why they have all a little more alcohol. My personal favorite is Wassail, because when Jamie brewed that back in 1988, it was so out there. You know, we were in the middle of fruit wheat beers, believe it or not. You know, back in the 80s, it was already some of that was there. And I just let it go. You know, it was kind of like, okay, let the brewer be creative. Let's see how this happens. I didn't think we were going to sell any, and I was wrong. And I think actually that did wonderful things for our relationship, because not long after that we got engaged and been married for 24 years. So Wassail's a personal favorite there. Let the brewer do his stuff. Yeah.
Now, Irene hired me, and I married the boss. We had some British visitors the other day, and we were telling that story, and they did the finger, you know, the shame on Irene.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah. Broke some human resource rules there, but, you know, there were only four of us, so what did it matter? Yeah. It all worked out, yeah.
He probably works harder now, too, then.
It was a really good personnel move, yeah, I would say.
Smarter than a look, okay.
Yeah. All right, and Bob, let's do it quick. So, Bobby, a favorite Christmas beer?
A couple of them. Desert Island beers are so difficult to pick, and usually I spend this time of year trying to sort of get a hit out of everything, you know, and try to find everything. But the first two Christmas beers I ever had are still mainstays for me, and that's Anchor Christmas and Sierra Celebration. Mm-hmm. One of the seek and find beers for me always, every Christmas, is the Sam Smith's Winter Welcome, which I absolutely love. It's just got that subtle, you know, that subtlety, that non-arms race, hops right. arms race, yeah. And just a must-go-to winter beer.
All right, Ray from St. Gambrinus Beer Shop.
It's easy for me. I would just make an Imperial Sierra Nevada Celebration.
Right. And Tim, I know you got a whole lineup, but pick one. You have way too many. I think you got a list of 50 Christmas beers I'm supposed to buy from you.
I mean, they're a ton. I mean, from imports to domestics. But I like to bring stuff to my family get-togethers when we have holiday events. And honestly, an unfiltered Pilsner for me is the way to go, because that appeals to everybody in my family, the hopheads, because Pilsners tend to be a little bit hoppier, unfiltered, because it gives it a really nice texture and depth, and it finishes super clean. Unfiltered Pilsners are the way to go.
All right, and Dave?
This Christmas I'm going to be bringing a cider that I've made. I've got these 200-year-old trees. My farmhouse was a tavern back in the 1780s, and they planted all these trees. They couldn't make beer, so they planted all these old trees, and I'm still harvesting them, and I kind of brought them back. And so I do an old Vermont style, which is you add raisins and molasses, which jacks up the alcohol a little bit. And makes it a little more complex and very, very Christmassy.
I think that's why I like that. I think I've had your cider before.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Yeah. All right. Well, hey, we're going to raise our glasses. This might be our Christmas show, even though this is 11 o'clock in the morning in November. And we're taking advantage of these great brewers from the Pacific Northwest visiting New York for our great brewers portfolio tasting. So I'd like to thank our sponsors again at greatbrewers.com who have helped to bring this podcast to you tonight. And we're supported by the Good Beer Seal. Blind Tiger, The Gate, and Jimmy's Number 43 are all members of the Good Beer Seal. You can follow us on Twitter at @beer_sessions. All right. Thanks to Dave, Bobby, Ray, Irene, Jamie, Dick, and everyone else for joining me here on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni. Thanks to our producers, Jack Inslee, Brie O'Connor, and Maggie Seiden, and Justin Kennedy, and our engineer, Joe Galarraga. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.